Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 6th of March, 2019. For 10 years, I've been doing this show on Russian Orthodox Nationalism. And when I first began on The Voice of Reason, I spent a lot of time on Russian literature. Of course, I have a book out on Russian literature, which, now that I've reviewed it for the first time in many years, it's has so many typos, it's embarrassing. Terrible typos. The arguments are sound, but it's just, I should have looked this over better. But at the time, things weren't quite as conducive to intellection as they are now. Russian literature is very different from what you have in the West. It's political, psychological, and most certainly religious. The problem is, those writing on these subjects, as I said last week, they're in departments of literature. They don't have an understanding of these fields. Gogol and Dostoevsky are saturated with arcane symbolism. And of course, Russians knew it back then, but no one today does. Certainly not in the academy, unless they're in fact initiated. I mean, the question is, how can urban, well-off, spoiled, tenured liberal professors, raised by CNN and MTV, lecturing to a captive audience, interpret men like Gogol and Dostoevsky? I mean, it's precisely that kind of mentality that these guys were attacking, and they don't know that they're being mocked. Well, it leads to tremendous pretentiousness amongst academics. Specialists in Russian literature are ignorant of the most essential elements of Russian life. To think you could read Dostoevsky or Gogol and know nothing about Orthodoxy, or, you know, Peter's Revolution, or the gathering of the Russian land in the time of troubles, anything like that is absurd. And worse than that, these people are so insulated from royalist thought, old traditionalist thought, what conservatism actually meant, thrown an altar. Against nominalism, which is, you know, taken for granted to such an extent that people think that it's reality as such. They're not capable of this. But these people also see these guys as great writers. So then they suffer with cognitive dissonance. There's a few, Eva Thompson, who's actually come out and defended the deliberate liberal distortion of these texts, saying that because Orthodoxy is obviously wrong and nationalism is wrong, therefore we have a right to tear apart these texts as we see fit. You know, she actually defends the inability to understand this stuff because there's nothing to understand that's worthwhile in her mind. That's how bad things have gotten. So, for example, I'll give you an example. It's very common for a modern academic writer to talk about Gogol's attack on Petersburg as somehow a repudiation of the Russian monarchy. They don't get that the Russian monarchy is in Moscow, not Petersburg. That Peter was revolutionary. Now, it's true what happened in the 19th century changed things, but this isn't something that they're aware of or even care about. So it's impossible for a lot of these guys to understand Russian literature. And so they the academic students, really the only people writing substantially on this stuff, don't have the capacity. These guys are coming from a world so religiously and ideologically far. The fact that they're writing in Russian is the least of their problems. You know, you can't heap contempt on Russian traditionalism, as these guys all do, while saying that Gogol and Dostoevsky, who defended these institutions, are great men. It doesn't make any sense. Remember, Solzhenitsyn, after his Harvard speech, among other things, was repudiated by the American establishment. They never liked him in the first place. There's a long FBI file on him that's now completely public. They never trusted him. They brought in good liberals instead. You know, Brusthoff and people like that. And Solzhenitsyn, he says this in 1989, an interview that doesn't exist in English. It's with a guy named David Aikman somewhere. He says this. He says, yes, according to the Christian view, history results from the interaction between the divine will and the free will of men. Obviously, God's will makes itself known, but not in any fatalistic manner. And the free will of individual men make itself known. It's this interaction between them that gives us history. However, in general, history is difficult to understand. For us, it's irrational. We can't plumb its depths. We must inevitably recognize that life is organic and develops as a tree grows or a river flows. Every disruption to its course is harmful and unnatural, and revolution is such a disruption. And other than saying that this is just blatantly reactionary, he's coming from a point of view that these people only understand in caricature. Unless history is conceived of as just this linear primitive to advanced, which is the Whig British Empire view, most Westerners don't get it. He'll be dismissed as obscurantist. So then, you know, there's one of two options. They either take these guys and say, oh no, they're really liberals, and I'll show you why. And they distort these things out of, you know, beyond belief. Or, like Eva Thompson and many others, just say, you know, they're not good. And while they say a few interesting things, they're defending the indefensible. And so they're not great writers. The truth is that we only understand progress to be a usable category only when we're talking about the struggle against the passions, these passions that lead to sin and death. The rest doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if knowledge and technical fields grow. It doesn't matter if capital becomes more and more efficient. You only define that as progress if you've already defined progress that way. When your universe is based on nominalism and you think that that's really what reality is, then interpreting anything outside of it becomes as tragicomic as Dostoevsky's characters. So that means I have a tremendous job to do, and I'm one of the few that are doing it. I want to talk about a couple of his shorter works. Now, Dostoevsky's works, you know, The Possessed, Crime and Punishment, Brothers Karamazov, these, you know, they've been interpreted to death. In Russian and English, the English, as I've said, is a complete disaster. There's some insight in Crime and Punishment that's not bad. Once in a while, you come across something good. But these other works are generally ignored, and we're going to see why in a minute. Last week, we spoke of The Underground Man. And if there's ever a man in literature that I've identified with, it's him. Well, either that or Levin in Anna Karenina. Either way, the superfluous man is a central theme because Russia had, because of Peter, had this very violent revolution in the beginning of the 18th century. And of course, that century was dedicated to deepening it. The first one I want to talk about is 1862, an unpleasant predicament. It's one of my favorites. Very few people know of it. It is an absolute masterwork in psychology. The theme here is political ideology that springs from disjointed causes, and they have tragicomic consequences. There's a false belief that someone adopts an ideological position because they're rational and they're sincere and they want to improve people and that they've analyzed all these texts, and they come to this conclusion. And of course, no one in history has ever done that. The story begins among three high-ranking bureaucrats, speaking of ethics, just after the reforms, this is 1862, of Alexander II. The youngest one has just been promoted to general which is a civil service rank, by the way, Ivan Illich, he's a progressive. And he's a progressive because everyone else is. Remember, the Petersburg nobility was anything but conservative. And it's nobility really by state decree, not by traditional lineage. We would call it virtue signaling today, is what he's doing. He wants to show off his dedication to the lot of humanity. And he's a young man, given a very high position, and there's no, you know, probably a corrupt reason why. And he's showing not really ideological type, but a psychological type. And Dostoevsky's, one of his great contributions is that there really isn't an ideological type. These are all psychological types. You understand people that way. As Nietzsche said, Dostoevsky is the only man who ever taught him anything worth a damn about psychology. But Illich speaks in almost instantly recognizable, cliched phrases, this empty void phrases to get him recognized. And you see this, you know, young guys in college trying to fit in and they support diversity and all this, young professors who live in fear of being called names. They say whatever they have to do to maintain their aplomb position. So he speaks, and he's speaking nonsense. It's just humanity, equality, no specifics, just chanting mantras that he's learned from the occasional conversation or a book or a salon meeting. They will embrace each other in a moral sense, he repeats. And he speaks that concerning those who work for him. He's gonna bring reform to the bureaucracy. He has no idea what that means. It just makes him sound good. And he puts on these airs as English empiricists, but he makes a fool of himself. Whenever anyone, uses phrase like, humanity, especially love, it's a code word for really what ultimately a foggy and inchoate Western set of liberal ideas, usually imposed by force. People think that ideology is autonomous, that ideas are placed in some sort of order, and then once you can impose it on a people, then it will have no other effect on a people other than what we say it will. If an ideology says that the individual is all that exists, once we teach people that that's the case, then things will be okay, and there won't be any nasty side effects except crazy people like us who cause trouble. But this really is a comedy. And he's making fun of the pretensions of these people. This is more direct than The Possessed. Now, he wants to try out these phrases at a wedding of one of his subordinates. Ivan believes that he has to treat his subordinates with the utmost inhumanity. He believes that if he arrives at this wedding party, which he hears that he was not invited to this thing, that if he shows up to this thing, he will enlighten everybody, raise their consciousness, and be treated with the utmost respect and deference. He daydreams how he's going to be the hero of the party. He's going to make speeches on liberal topics, and tears of joy will flow everywhere. And the young couple will remember this for the rest of their married lives. Now, the man getting married has a name with no meaning. It's Seldomov. Pseldomov. Now, it's a bureaucratic error. And he says this deliberately. It's Pseudomov, as in, pseudo, as in false. But we're not entirely sure of that. But because of a bureaucratic error, at some point in his life, he has to live with this. And now he has this ridiculous name, Seldomov. Which shows you that, these names, this is, the Petersburg bureaucracy and the liberal state, liberal authoritarian state, determines your identity. He earns only 10 rubles a month. He's very low level. And this is why the general's going to go and enlighten him. And he thinks this is just going to be the greatest favor he can do these people. And the level of daydreaming, we know that these people do this. He starts thinking in the most grandiose terms. This is what he says. As he's going to the party, this is what he's saying to himself. They will know my heart. They'll know my essential nature. He is stern as chief, they will say of me, but as a man, he's an angel. Then I will have conquered them. I should have conquered them by one little act which would have never entered my colleague's head. They will be mine. I should be their father, and they my children. Why am I morally elevating the humiliated? I restore him to himself. My name will be imprinted on the hearts of all. The devil only knows what might come of that popularity. We all know who this is. Now, this is the 40-something female who reads two books on herbal healing and thinks she's a doctor. It's the board member of the big-name corporation who sends millions of dollars to lift the front groups. It's a career woman who gives over her children to the daycare 10 hours a day so she could uplift womanhood in the corporate world. It's the liberal clergyman who dreams of founding an ecumenical church to worship the moral nature of man and his progress. But what do all these people have in common? It certainly isn't reason. It's desire. It's will. They claim that they want to uplift and to heal. Now, everyone else in the past who said anything like that, they're false. Only they are beyond self-interest. Everyone else is based on some class interest or something. Everyone but them. And academics go on about different classes in society, wanting more and demanding taking power because they want a greater share of wealth. They always exempt themselves from this power seeking. But really what they want is to control, to dominate, to gain a reputation, maybe to make money, to be recognized as somebody, to be accepted by the powerful, to be praised, to be considered independent or intellectual, to be affirmed as superior. See, liberalism, however it's formed, and here you had a monarchy, but really in Petersburg it was a bureaucratic regime, at least at the federal level, but the monarchy had limited power to control, especially in the 18th century. That was changing slowly in the 19th. Can't get into that right now, but you know, the ideology of the nobility was liberalism. And liberalism is based on the idea that people come to their religious and moral convictions in a vacuum. That they have a blank slate at one point, and they read all the major works in a certain field, in each ideology and point of view. They make a pro-con list, and then after a certain amount of time, they make a decision. Now, of course, no one has ever done this. This is ridiculous. Our motivations are far more complex than that. But again, liberal ideology is based on that. If reason doesn't control this, then passion does. If passion drives reason, then people certainly aren't free, but they're controlled by these inner drives that are very difficult to control or even understand. So again, it's about psychology. So Ivan enters the wedding party, absolutely certain he's going to be treated like royalty. And for the rest of the novel, it's not very long, the comedy works itself out. And it really is tragic, and you can't tell whether you should laugh or cry. You feel bad for the guy. But when he shows up, the guests are very divided about him. About half of them are just absolutely servile, seeking some kind of favor. Others treat him with contempt. See, most of the attendees are of the lower class. So they either grovel or they hate him. There's a few journalists who were there, and they show him the worst contempt. Slowly, the general starts to realize something. He's living like all these people. I mean, most of them don't ever realize this. But his cognitive dissonance starts to get to him. How can he talk about equality and liberty when he's using the artificial ranking system of Peter the Great to impose his system upon others? How can a lover of equality talk about a vanguard party? How can the lover of equality, lover of liberty, talk about how you could force people through a revolutionary party to finally understand who they really are? Rousseau says that, and Ivan says that right in the quote I just mentioned. I'll bring him to himself. Finally, he'll wake up and know what he is. But of course, we need to use force for that. And he's starting to realize that this is a problem. Wherever liberalism has been imposed, it's been imposed by force. Whether it be China under Sen, Britain under Cromwell, French Revolution, American university system, from Holland to South Africa, from Reconstruction to desegregation, liberalism always has to be imposed at the barrel of a gun. This is both comic and tragic, and this is how, and this is one of the reasons, of course, this is ignored and is not talked about very much, because, of course, he's pointing directly at university professors. And how could they possibly not realize this? See, ideology is abstract. It's general. But life is particular and specific. And ideologues believe that general concepts can be imposed on a specific way of life. I did my doctoral dissertation on Michael Oakeshott, and his Rationalism in Politics and other works like that are based on this idea, and the space between those two, of course, has to be filled with violence. Well, it becomes clear that very few people want him there, and they're very uncomfortable with him there. Now, we learn a bit more about Seldomov. He comes from the lowest form of urban poverty. His father died young. He was homeless. His mother or grandmother was far older than normal. As his only friend, really. And they were, you know, which was humiliating at the time. His mother did laundry and had, you know, essentially as a domestic for in an apartment. They had a little corner to themselves. Somehow, though, he got this lowest of bureaucratic positions at 10 rubles a month. And he's looking for this marriage because he's looking for property. So he's found a young girl abused by her father, a girl with obvious mental problems, whose father really wants her out of the house. Now, the father is a drunk, a retired bureaucrat. He has a small house outside the city, but it's filthy. At least there's some property that might be improved on it, though. And his father treats Seldomov with contempt. He forces him to dance and sing to keep him entertained. He wants to prove his submissiveness. And he likes the guy over time because he appears weak, the perfect son-in-law. So these are the two personalities that are coming together here. So you have a marriage based entirely on the most unhealthy motives. And this guy coming to crash the wedding with the most unhealthy of motives. See, the general hasn't considered the real life situation he's in. He figures that because they're inferior to him in the pecking order, they're actually inferior in reality. See, even literature itself, these stories are very specific. Unlike, you know, a manifesto, which is very general. But Ivan hadn't considered that maybe this family's poor. Which, of course, he knew was true. But that means that by his arrival, it was customary to serve him a far higher quality of food and drink. Way out of their price range. He hadn't considered that. When someone like that comes to your house, you can't serve him what you serve to everybody else. Now, his father-in-law had given only a small amount for this, Seldomov's father-in-law, and gave him only the bare minimum. So now, the general shows up uninvited, and Seldomov, they need to buy champagne and caviar and things, because that's what you have to give someone like that when they show up. It would be a terrible affront if they didn't. So he destroyed the party. They had to completely change everything. They were going more broker than they thought they'd be. And then, making matters worse, Ivan, who drank too much, he tries to make a lofty speech on equality, passes out on the floor, drunk and sick. So that's what comes of his attempt to elevate his inferiors. So then, there's only one bed in the house, and that's the marriage bed. It's a tiny place. It's a nuptial bed, which the general then proceeds to vomit on. Then the bride had to go to a drawing room. It's kind of a makeshift nuptial couch with a new husband, falls out of the tiny bed. Because, you know, back then, you broke the woman's hymen while the wedding party was still there. And in some places, you would actually show the blood, proving that she's a virgin. Can you imagine doing that today? There are no virgins. You get married. Anyway, so she falls out of the couch. They're trying to do it, and you know, it's uncomfortable enough as it is. The general's passed out in vomit-covered bed. and she falls and the entire party crashes into the room, really to humiliate the girl, who then goes running out of the room. She never liked the arrangement to begin with. Ah, but then she runs right into the arms of a young officer she had her eye on the whole time. Everything ends in disaster, and Seldomov is broken completely alone. It's a bizarre situation that really an intelligent guy, not motivated by ideology and the sense of moral superiority, would have been able to figure out. Ideology and life don't go together. Ideology is it has nothing to do with philosophy, has nothing to do with principles. Ideology is about progress, the belief that we have uncovered the secret of history and we can offer secular salvation. That's what an ideology is. It has nothing to do with principles or anything else. This is what liberalism is, Marxism is, anarchism is. This bizarre situation shows you how just ridiculous ideology can be. Now, the possessed is a much larger explanation of this. This is a much simpler version and more direct. The general vomiting all over the wedding bed just shows you how unnatural the situation is. They're mixing elements that can't be mixed without nausea. They have rejected the general just as he's rejected their own food and drink. And by the way, he wasn't used to any of that. You know, they gave it to him because they thought they should, but he himself wasn't really used to that. He was just been promoted. Those of you who've read Pushkin's The Bronze Horseman, there's a similar character there. I mean, Seldomov and Eugene, they're both alienated bureaucrats, low level. They both have romantic dreams. Both are very low rank. They're both victimized by the system. They're always trying to better themselves, and they believe that by betterment, they mean getting the next higher rank. And as I've said many times on this show, Petersburg is based on this. It is the archetypal Western city. It has nothing to do with Russia at all. In fact, as many of you know, Russian dress was illegal. Nevsky Prospect, anyone wearing a beard or Russian traditional dress, was either arrested or had to pay money. That's how much he hated Russian history. But in The Bronze Horseman, Peter, in attempting to control nature with this floating city of Petersburg, a flood comes and destroys the place, and he wipes out everything that he thought was important. So the unpleasant predicament here, which is the title of the piece, is not just the public humiliation of this young general who had absolutely no, you know, like so many professors and others who had no reason to be in the position he's in. But while preaching freedom, they use force, as they all do. While preaching brotherhood, they demand ideological conformity. They preach equality, but they use money and position to alter society in secret. Ideologues have no understanding of life. Most people don't care about their diversity obsession, whatever the trendy idea is. Ideology outside of life leads to frustration and death. The guy laying on the nuptial bed, breaking the family, destroying the marriage, creating adultery immediately, showing the fraud of not just what he was preaching, but also of this ridiculous marriage. Because really, Seldomov is no better than the general is. He likes this, I don't know if she's retarded, I mean, she clearly has mental illness. This is a monstrous father. And he has some money, he can manipulate her, maybe put her away at some point, and take it all for himself when the father dies. So he's not really a sympathetic figure. And so, our plans, what we think we're going to end up doing, comes crashing down. Ideology is the secular salvation. It's the Gnostic conception of Erich Vogel. Now, speaking of which, one of my favorite and almost completely ignored short stories of Dostoevsky is The Dream of a Strange Man, 1877, sometimes called Dream of a Ridiculous Man, the Dream of an Absurd Man. This is so loaded with arcane symbolism that it's really untouched by commentators. And when they try to touch it, it's pretty humorous. The story is very different from what you'd expect from him. This is a work of really of strong agrarianism. The idea of Eden and its counterpart, or I should say its mirror, civilization. Eden and civilization are opposites. And this comes up far more in Gogol than it does elsewhere. Remember, civilization is a creation of Cain. There was never any time that man existed without civilization. But it's an urban phenomenon. And the whole notion of a city is so elites can keep workers close by and kept under control. But civilization, and I talk about culture here. Well, Russians made a big deal, and Spengler did as well. The distinction between civilization and culture. Civilization is about power. It's inherently Gnostic. For people like Danilevsky, it's what happens when culture begins to decay. The elites start to see their power fading, and they start demanding more and more out of the natural order, which, of course, requires sacrifice. But all arcane understanding, all the occult systems, derive from this radical separation of man from nature, forcing man to live in a world of images rather than the reality of creation. This dream is a polemical attack on the occult. And remember how popular Freemasonry was, the Russian elite, in the 19th century. It's extremely important to the elite. Orthodoxy, especially in Petersburg, was largely in memory. And the elite and the people always had it, of course, and the old believers always had it. But the nobility had abandoned it, and in its place came Western Freemasonry, thanks to Peter. Like every other story in Russian literature in the 19th century, it revolves around alienation. After the scythe of Saturn has fallen, which you see the scythe in the Soviet flag, which refers to civilization as manifesting power through alienation, it cuts man off from heaven. Men are alienated from the earth, the basis of all earthly goods, of course, and so they look for artificial things to meet their needs, human sacrifice, expansion, slavery, everything else. So whoever controls access to this controls the world. And I learned this from a man who really changed my life, and that's Michael Hoffman. I spent a lot of time, and made the first one that I'm aware of that made the argument that this is what the occult sciences all are. It's rebuilding society once the science of Saturn has cut heaven off from Earth. Technology fills the gaps when men are severed from the natural order and its creator. Elites realize that technology and the ethos of the city or king can create greater profits, control the organization, rather than civil dependence on nature. So Michael Hoffman says this. Many of you have probably read this book already, but I love this section. This passage really changed my life a long time ago. The sickle symbolizes Saturn, also known as Kronos Saturn, or as the Greeks called it, the Demiurgos, the operating engineer of the universe as opposed to the creator of that universe. The reign of Saturn, we see exorbitant building and modeling activities, and this is reflected in the Masonic reference to their god as a big builder or architect. This sounds reasonably attractive. Many of us can appreciate magnificent buildings and splendid projects. There's more to it than this. Saturnian Masonic edifice complex ultimately is building against the grain, against nature. Though at the beginning, in the early eras, nature's forces are manipulated with the knowledge which requires the greatest intimacy with her ways, as reflected in the megalithic structures of the British Isles, Europe, and America. Man began his progression away from Eden through the conceit that he would become as God. As soon as he left the divine plan, the occult process, his stated objective, became Tikkun Olam, the repair of the world, via the intervention and imposition of human brain power, the very egomaniacal device that caused the separation of God's natural Eden in the first place. In the Hermetic and Masonic tradition, the secret identity of Satan is a cosmic force represented in the occult lore as emanating from it, the Dark Star Sirius, Alpha Canis Majoris. The secret tradition of the Freemasons, Sirius is overwhelmingly identified with a single primary attribute, the bringing of civilization to Earth. of that passage completely changed my life. All Masonic, all occult doctrine goes back to this concept. Once man and God are separated, there no longer is any natural order because there is no lawgiver. There's no law, there's no lawgiver. Therefore, man has to build it himself. Now, this is, I have to say this because you can't read the rest of this story without understanding it. Partially because the Dog Star, Sirius, makes its appearance. And it's not the only story in this era where Sirius shows up. Petersburg itself is a Masonic ritual. The city itself, building it, it was a revolution. He used the forced labor of old Russia, or the Cossack Coast, to build this city, the most difficult and cold swamp in the world, near the Finnish border. About 10,000 were killed, deliberately. The city was literally built on the bones of old Russia. Everything that Peter and his Masonic friends in Holland and England thought was backward and deranged. A new European city dedicated to finance, military might, industrialism, the new megastate, was literally meant to conquer nature itself. Not merely the symbolic building of the city in a terrible place from, you know, which is Petersburg's in such a ridiculous place. There's no strategic value of being up there. It's a ritual. It's meant to be the most inhospitable place, showing that I, Peter, can destroy nature itself and dominate it. It's powerful from a magical point of view. It's the city that will bring about the industrialization of Russia through serf labor. The new European city, of course, cities have always been like this. But in the modern era, the megastate has created a new city dedicated to finance, military might, industrialism. But the anti-hero in most of these stories, and in this one here, is tired of this. He sees no point to the obsession with power. The drive for power leads to the accumulation of more power. And then you're afraid of losing it, so you need more power to make sure you defend against it. Then others around you have to gain more power to make sure that you don't gain any more. This circle seems bizarre, and it is. And this anti-hero here wants to kill himself. He's walking home. He meets a poor girl, one of the cast-offs, the sacrifices. One of the sacrifices needed to make a modern city function. She's calling out for help. And she's rebuffed. No one in the story has names, by the way. Because in the city, this is all swallowed up. This woman has a, or a girl, whoever, has a sick mother, and this anti-hero tells her to go to hell. Civilization is for the elites, for their problems, for their desires for power, and security to maintain that power. To this day, civilization has been incapable of assisting girls like this, no matter who's in charge. But the second reason, really, why the anti-hero rebuffs the girl is that he's found the secret to freedom, that he's going to kill himself. This is the ultimate negation of everything. It's the ultimate self-determination. He deals with it in the possessed and also in the idiot, but never as explicitly here as in a dream. Imminent death is a great liberator because all our earthly problems go away. Whatever issues we have, debt we have, romantic problems we have, they're gone. Who cares now? I'm not going to be around tomorrow. It makes him, for this short period of time, almost all-powerful. So much here is necessary. I mean, to try to even scratch the surface, what's necessary to understand what's happening here. We put it this way. The German idealists, which were very, very important in Russia at the time, began to argue that the human ego posits the world and, in fact, projects the world around it. That reality is the mind, mutual experience creates a sort of intersubjective unity among things. Reality really is a creation of the mind, and the self is a creation, it's a creator of the world. So you have a deeply occult element, people like Schelling, that he can create the world through his projection, he can destroy it through his suicide. The suicidal man is made a god, because now he's above moral obligation. Since the world depends upon his will, he's destroying the world and the ground of the self. Dostoevsky's fascinated by this idea. And of course, his commentators have completely missed it. They don't get it. Because they haven't read people like Shelley. They don't understand that the German idealist tradition that had penetrated Russia, which had very positive elements in some areas, like Fichte, stated that man projects the world out of himself. Well, if that's true, not only do I create the world, but I can destroy it. Anyway, just prior to returning to his room, the anti-hero here, the clouds part, and showing Sirius, the dog star. This star then gives him the idea of being like God, and his desire for suicide is connected to this godlike state. Dostoevsky knew his Masonic symbolism, and he knew that Orthodox people would get it, would understand it. Moderns would have no idea what he's talking about, but they would. The stuff that was taken for granted even just 150 years ago is long gone today. He's linking the secret abode of Satan, the dog star, with civilization, as well as suicide and the bizarre belief in godlikeness. It should be, I want to note that Michael Hoffman has a footnote to that quote I mentioned above, that this star, so important to the adepts of the occult, is also the realm of Isis in Egyptian mythology. The ancient writings dealing with this goddess, she had great skill in manipulating nature using special magical words. There's more to it. The star is important to many cultures, not just Egyptian. It's everywhere. Hoffman says, the name Shaitan is a form of Set, one of the myriad names, in this case Egyptian, for the entry Sirius, Osothis, the state of the goddess Isis, as well as the jackal-headed deity Anubis. Now, I've made this argument, I've expanded on Michael Hoffman's idea here, that, of course, we can understand Satan, and he has manifested himself in the Egyptian god Set. Having rebuffed the girl and began seeing the dog star, he's disturbed. There's an intuitive understanding that he's done wrong. He doesn't know why he feels this way. He does. And then he falls asleep. He dreams in his sleep that he's killed himself. He's then taken by an unknown force through the heavens, past the dog star, and is brought to a double of this, an imitation, a double of the solar system, a copy of the solar system, a double of the earth, and he's being brought to Eden. Being brought past the dog star to Eden, for those of us who understand this stuff, makes perfect sense. The anti-hero was brought to earth prior to the fall of Adam, prior to civilization. Now, here's how he describes what he finds, the people that he finds on earth, people living in Eden. I understood at once, even at the time, that many things I couldn't understand as an up-to-date Russian progressive and contemptible Petersburger. It struck me as inexplicable that knowing so much, they had, for instance, no science like ours. I realized that their knowledge was gained and fostered by intuitions, different from us, that their aspirations were very different. They didn't desire anything. They were at peace. They didn't aspire to knowledge of life because their lives were full. The knowledge that was higher and deeper than ours. Our science seeks to explain what life is, aspires to understand it in order to teach others how to love. Well, they, without science, knew how to live. And I understood, but I couldn't understand their knowledge. They showed me their trees. I couldn't understand the intense love which they looked at them. It was as though they were talking with creatures like themselves. Perhaps I shouldn't be mistaken if I said that they conversed with them. They were as happy. They were as sportive as children. They wandered about their lovely woods. They sang songs. Their fare was like fruit to the trees, honey from the woods, milk of the animals who loved them. The work they did for food and raiment was brief and not laborious. They loved and begot children. I never noticed any lustful impulse. Each is almost the source of every sin in mankind on earth, of course. They rejoiced at the arrival of children as new beings to share their happiness. There is no fighting, no quarreling, no jealousy. They didn't even know what the word meant. Their children were the children of all. They made up one communal family. There was no illness, no sickness. There was death, but their old people died peacefully, like falling asleep, giving blessings and smiles to those who surrounded them to take their last farewell with bright and lovely smiles. Of course, he's talking about man before civilization. He's talking about man before the fall of Adam and this copy of the earth. You see, technically, these people didn't know anything. But what that means is they didn't know anything discursively. They'd be considered backwards according to the Whig understanding of history. But discursive reason is the use of concepts and linear logic. That means that they're alienated and they're fragmented, and so they use these different concepts to try to put together some sense of unity of the world. But these people here, just like Adam and Eve, they didn't need logic. They didn't need words. They knew intuitively. They had an immediate connection to the world around them. We have immediate connection. So logic in the modern sense, this is the language of mechanization, the fall. See, for these people, you see it even in the Russian peasantry at the time, nature wasn't dead matter, but it was alive. There are plenty of urbanites in Russia who swore that peasants were able to talk to animals. They knew them so well. And there's some truth to this. This has been said many, many times. And of course, the very holy monks at Optian and elsewhere, animals were never scared of them. They didn't need concepts. They just felt. Think of a toddler loving its mother. It can't explain to you why. It just does. This is how they're related to everything. They didn't use many words at all here. But their concepts, whatever little they had, were full and very rich, and it was innocent. It was almost telepathy. Nature became their temple. Well, needless to say, this anti-hero is going to corrupt them. And he doesn't do it on purpose. It begins with one small lie, but in a realm of innocence, a realm without any defenses against stuff like that, it germinates into a full fall into civilization. In other words, corruption of this Eden derives from a fallen man making contact with people who knew nothing of defending themselves from corruption. They had no idea. They didn't know how to fight. They didn't know how to fight back. They didn't understand that anyone could have ill will towards them, even if it's indeliberate. He brings civilization to Eden, but he also brings death in the worst sense. He brings separation, which is the literal meaning of alienation. The minute he shows up and starts talking to them and starts being suspicious, not understanding what he's seeing, suddenly they become cruel to animals. They start using animals for profits. They start selling them. Animals now retreat into the forest. They avoid people. They begin developing theories, ideas of the world, and they form parties, and they start hurting each other. One wants to impose its ideology on another one. They develop all kinds of ideologies about economics to justify their abuse of nature and the animals around them. Suddenly, they soon realize that the logic that they've just learned will not solve their problems. They begin to believe that their suffering is just a part of life, and they simply accept it, and they resign themselves. It's very unclear, really, what he does to set off this train of events, except that the tiniest little look of suspicion in a purely innocent, pure society is enough to get it started. The minute people have the idea that they can gain power over others, there's going to be some who are going to try it. And if they do that, whether you like it or not, you have to defend yourself against it. So all it takes is one person to say, I want to gain power and profit over everybody else, and whether you like it or not, you have to defend yourself. So with one person, the entire society is corrupted. And essentially, they go through the entire history of the world in, you know, a week. You know, he actually goes through the entire post-Enlightenment development of intellectual line. He goes from the kind of the naive logic of the early Enlightenment, the German idealists, and eventually ends with Schopenhauer. He actually goes through the history of philosophy and the Enlightenment in this very brief tale of their corruption. In other words, the final thesis here is that the formula of ideology, political, moral, scientific, doesn't have meaning in itself. They're the phenomena of the will to power of individuals. Because of that, they're not really ideals. They're just will. So again, here's another powerful indictment of ideology and the faddish slogans that were dominating the Russian nobility at the time. Again, you could see why the average faculty lounge scribbler has no idea what he's saying here. And they really avoid it. They have no idea, for example, you know, so many Orthodox saints have been able to talk to animals. Even Seraphim Rose was able to do it. Many monks, Seraphim Sarov, you know, they begin to develop this non-discursive intuitive reasoning. How quickly this Eden is destroyed. And how easily. Remember, Adam was never perfect. He was just innocent. But the problem is that he had no defenses. He didn't know, he really didn't know how to, you know, when you're that, when life is that easy, you have no idea how to, I don't have any time to go into some of the other things that I had. I only have 9 minutes here. But the clear lessons here, beyond the ken of the average academic and journalist, something those of us who are outside of the society, the underground people who we are, can comprehend. And I want to talk about something that I said. This was actually in relation to Solzhenitsyn. And what I did, I think I'll do next time, his Cancer Ward and the First Circle, which is the Cancer Ward certainly is my favorite work of Solzhenitsyn's. And the two of them had a lot in common, of course. Not the least of which is that they both were in a prison camp. But I came up with a few things that I thought connected them. This is ages ago. And I think it brings the entire tradition of Russian literature together. The first thing is that happiness, which by the way is not comfort, can be found anywhere. It's really a state of mind. It has nothing to do with external factors or progress or anything like this. Ideology can't bring happiness. You see how quickly just even the tiniest little thing destroyed this Edenic society in Dream of a Ridiculous Man. Importantly, you realize in the same dream, there's an immediate connection between their so-called enlightenment and government. I don't just mean the state, I mean any kind of coercive power. It's built on material objects, control over the unexplained motion of objects is a drop of science. So then we could create institutions scientifically and try to make people happy. This is kind of the Victorian morality based on utility and the pursuit of pleasure. And there's no intrinsic purpose to man. The state, of course, and capital grow tremendously. The third thing is that the Enlightenment, the ideology, I mean, this is really where ideology comes from. It's really based on the interconnection of all external stimuli. Because there's nothing more than vibrations. We're nothing more than nerve endings. Then totalitarianism becomes a practical and scientific necessity. If applied in one area, it could be applied in all areas. And Solzhenitsyn spends a lot of time doing this. The Enlightenment has to have a totalitarian state. Peter the Great, when he took over, declared war on Russia. So he needed to develop more and more sources of funding, more and more sources of power. Became more and more arrogant, alienated completely, a monster who tortured death his own son. Power became an obsession to the point where he was man, as Nietzsche was. The fourth thing is that ideology can never be a motivation. It's not a motivation either in fact or in theory. It's a personal matter. Any revolution has to start with us. Any counter-revolution has to start with us. Material progress is not related to happiness. And that's, that, by the way, I mean, people take that for granted. But we forget just a couple hundred years ago how revolutionary that idea was. It was an extremely radical idea. But if we reject that idea, understand the entire modern world comes crashing down. If happiness is a certain piece of our soul, a soul that's freed itself from the material world, material progress is not related to happiness, not just unrelated to happiness, it becomes a barrier to it. Because the more production develops, the more society comes to identify with its progressive nature. But if this nature, progressive nature, itself is based on technology and science, then society has, through the medium of the elites, created a moral axiom. The more one has, the happier one will be. But of course, we know that this isn't true. That none of this is true. No one ever asked if progress brings happiness. They could define it any way they want. But never, ever, ever do they make reference to happiness. They never make the claim that those, say, in the realm of Augustus are less happy than Americans of the 1960s. That would be a stupid thing to say. And I've said this in Solzhenitsyn and in Dostoevsky. When I talked about, also with Vasil Stus, because of the sick nature of society, prison becomes a symbol of freedom. Because all of those social norms that you see in, you know, with the general crashing the wedding party, all these things they have to, they no longer exist. They're gone. It's almost like a suicide. All of your social obligations go away. Everything that you were before is gone. You're a completely new person once you go to prison. Prison is the only place in Stus and Solzhenitsyn and in Dostoevsky where you're free from the social customs and the Enlightenment mentality. Happiness is not to be found even in studying psychology. I mean, they come to exist in history outside of the moral autonomy of the person. You know, moral purity comes to exist through suffering. Suffering is the usual props and buttresses of external comforts. Not really part of the moral imagination. Autonomy comes through suffering. Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn, Stus were changed radically because of their time in prison. Suffering made them who they were. As I said last week, in Dostoevsky, the Notes from Underground, he had a certain liberation. While he accepted the social norms of the era, he was rejected from society. He really was a reject. There's a certain power that comes with that. There's a certain strength that comes with that. We're the only ones who could see society the way it is. You can't see something when you're in the middle of it. A fish doesn't know it's in water because it's everywhere. Those of us on land know that. That means those that are successful, those who are doing well, those who aren't doing well but want to do well, they can't see what they're doing. Kind of like a man being in love. I mean, when you're out of love, you look back and you go, my God, I can't believe I did that. It's the same thing here. When you're in the middle of it, you don't get it. You're in the moment and you're fighting and you can't believe what you do half the time. That's because you can't see yourself objectively. Those of us who are rejected, those of us who are proudly rejected, those of us who are considered dead, you know, I mean, Gogol has dead souls, Solzhenitsyn talks about this all the time. Dostoevsky has House of the Dead. You know, death here is metaphorical, but very, very real. It is a certain level of freedom because we and only we can see the world for what it is. In the last 2 weeks, really everything I've done on Russian literature comes from the strength that comes from alienation, the strength that comes from being a reject. Anybody who was successful, whether it be in Petersburg or in modern America, really can't be a decent person. Because nice guys finish last. Unfortunately, that's true. Someone who is nice to his employees and treats them well and spends money on them will not be as competitive as someone who works in the debt. This is an unfortunate fact. The virtues, so-called virtues that you need to be successful are in fact vices. That means decent people will not be successful. You will be on the outskirts, will be prophets. And Gogol saw himself that way, Dostoevsky saw himself that way, and to some extent, Solzhenitsyn saw himself some way. So when Solzhenitsyn came to America, and he began talking like this, he was vehemently rejected. He was rejected by the political class and by the literary class. You recall Solzhenitsyn teaching at a university? Or getting a big job at some corporate? No. He was completely rejected. He was hounded not just by the KGB, but also by the FBI. That they were allies more than they were enemies. He was an enemy of materialism and nominalism and secularism, which unifies all the titanic movements. All these movements dedicated to creating an edifice, the edifice complex, as Michael Hoffman talks about. That's what this all comes down to. The Tower of Babel. But of course, even if they were successful, they never would have been happy. It never would have been over. All it takes is one guy to try to gain power over others, and all of us then have to follow in his wake. We have to. We can't let him dominate us. So it takes one person to corrupt the entire society. That's a tragedy of Eden. It's a tragedy of our life. And very few people, other than Dostoevsky, made that very clear. Out there, what we're facing is not ideology or ideas. That's nonsense. These people will abandon it tomorrow if it was in their interest. It is the will to power. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.